Welcome back to Supreme Myths. I am excited today to talk about a fantastic new book with one of our best national constitutional law professors. Maxwell Stearns is here. He is a chaired professor at the University of Maryland, a graduate of UVA and University of Pennsylvania. He is a law and economics expert, and as everyone knows who listens to this pod, once a pod, I have to mention Judge Richard Posner, so probably at some point in this pod, we might get to something Posner said about this, but we'll see. His law review articles have appeared in Yale, Stanford, Notre Dame, Penn, all kinds of places. He's written a bunch of books, but his latest book that's just out is truly groundbreaking, and I think everybody should read it. I have read it. It is called Parliamentary America, the Least Radical Means of Repairing Our Broken Democracy. Thank you so much for being here, Max.
Thank you so much. I'm going to make one small adjustment.
Yes, it's
the least radical means of radically repairing our broken democracy.
Sorry. Yes. And radically is important. No, that's important. Okay, we're going to get right into it here. In your introduction, almost the beginning of the book, you say before any good reforms can really happen, or any meaningful reforms, we must get past American exceptionalism. Now, Max, when I think of American exceptionalism, the two things that come to my mind are a Supreme Court like no other and guns. Those are the two things that I think make us exceptionally bad. What do you mean by American exceptionalism? How long has this been an idea, and how does it fit into your overall structure of the book?
So let me say, I agree with you that America is exceptional in the two areas that you've mentioned.
But that's not, exceptionally bad.
But that's not what I mean when I use the term American exceptionalism, although it's symptomatic of what I call American exceptionalism. So when I think of American exceptionalism, I think of the idea that from the time that most of us who were raised in the United States, sometimes born and raised in the United States, we've been taught that something special and unique about the American Constitution has allowed it to endure for longer than any other constitution operating in a democracy anywhere else in the world. And so we're led to believe that longevity is the key to wisdom and soundness. And we ought not to tinker with this thing. This ought to be given the reverential status that people frequently give to ancient religious texts. And I think that's a profound mistake. I think that we need to revisit the lessons of our childhood and think more critically about what we've learned, because it may be the case that the US system has thrived for almost a quarter millennium, in spite of, not because of, the unique constitutional design. And if you think about the test that we generally use to evaluate the wisdom and soundness of systems, whether we're talking about engineering models, whether we're talking about business models, whether we're talking about science, even artistic genres, rarely would we say that a single example that has endured longer than others is the ultimate test. Usually the test that we'd use is replication. Is this something that has been adapted benignly across different settings in a way that really is deeply meaningful? And when it comes to our system of democracy, the United States has been a recluse on the world stage. We've exported democracy throughout history, but we've never successfully exported two-party presidentialism. Instead, most successful democratic systems operate through a combination of proportionality or proportional representation and consensus systems or coalition governance.
So we'll get to that in a second, but I just want to say right away, like when you read the first 10 pages of this book, there's an idea that I find novel and interesting, which is when we talk about American exceptionalism, we normally look at our country, look at other countries, and say, how are we doing compared to other countries? And I've had numerous people on this podcast point out things like we have, you know, the worst childcare system in the world, basically, of any free country, and so on and so forth. And then we can talk about the good parts about America, and we can debate and discuss that. But you're coming at it from a very different perspective that I've seen before. Your perspective is our Constitution exceptional in any way that suggests we should not modify it greatly, or your words, radically? And that's a different idea, I think, and I love that idea, like going back to the beginning and saying, how smart was this really from the beginning? What has it turned into? Which is a different idea than how good is our childcare compared to France. I think those are very different ideas. Is that fair?
Oh, that's totally fair. And I think totally right. And so I'm not focusing necessarily specifically on particular public policies, and we can have those.
Right.
I'm happy to talk about those things, but I, you know, what I'm really trying to get to is an underlying pathology that really lies beneath all of the sort of dissension we have over policy, this sort of widening divisions respecting substantive policies. So I think that's a great characterization.
Max, you say in very close to the beginning, our constitutional system is broken. So before, obviously, my wife teaches critical thinking and problem solving at Emory Business School. And she says the biggest mistake people in business make, and I think this is the biggest mistake lawyers make too, is trying to solve a problem before you identify the problem completely. That you rush to a solution without really understanding the problem. This is a big deal in corporate America, I guess. I have no idea. But she tells me that. I believe her. She's smart. So you say our constitutional system is broken. How you view it as broken, I assume, is directly related to your remedies for fixing this broken system. So can you give us a few minutes on why our system is broken?
So what I'll say is that, you know, we need to come to this idea that there is a root cause and that we have to identify the root cause. And you've got it exactly right. Your wife has it exactly right. My wife's an academic physician. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I like to quote from her is she'll say, never order a test unless you know what you're going to do with the results.
Right. That's a great thing. I love that. Wait, I love that. I love that. That's great.
Yes. Well, I'm always happy to pass along the wisdom of my brilliant wife. So that's right. And so what we have to do is we have to get the pathology right. And part of the difficulty is that going back to the lessons we learned in middle school, high school, even sometimes in law school, is this idea that the framers had this conception of the Constitution that I call a rock, paper, scissors game. And at a later point, I call it a unicycle Constitution. This idea that for each branch of government, another branch could defeat it or it could defeat. And then we layer on top of this federalism. So we have these rival jealousies between and among the branches of government, and of course, at levels of government between the federal government and state and local governments. And these rival jealousies, if we go back to the Federalist Papers, are supposed to break and control the violence of factions. So we'd never have these entrenched, what the framers call factions. We could think of them as precursors to political parties. But in fact, you can go back to the very beginning. You can go back to George Washington's farewell address to see that even then, right? Even then, partisanship was overtaking this rock, paper, scissors, or unicycle game with divisions between two parties. Now, we've had more than two parties in transitional periods, but the framers set up a system whereby inevitably over time, we were going to have geographically defined district elections in the House, states as larger districts, usually in the Senate, a national, very large district process through this peculiar institution, the Electoral College, for the presidency. And when you set things up that way, everybody learns quickly that the key to winning when one person's chosen from a geographical location in an election, the key is to keep your side intact and fracture the opposition. That's mutual. So both sides strive to keep their side intact, fracture the opposition, and we ended up with a two-party system really pretty early on that entrenched itself, of course, over the years and kind of went haywire in the very modern period, which I refer to as the information age.
So the last question before we get to some of your suggestions, solutions. So Mac, one of the things I've tried to do on this podcast, and I think this part has been somewhat successful, is have people on who are saying, and don't take this the wrong way, original things that are not stupid in constitutional law or about politics, because I think it is virtually impossible to say original things about constitutional law or politics in our society. And my standard for somebody who's saying something original is simply, is it not stupid? Now, your book is 10 million levels above not stupid. But there's one thing you say that fascinated me so much. And I don't want to spend too much time on this because we could spend 5 hours on this. We could write a book on this. I think you're the first person I've read, and maybe you can tell me I'm wrong, who has suggested that checks and balances and separation of powers those ideas that we learn, we do, even today in our ridiculously uneducated America, school children learn about checks and balances and separation of powers and we didn't want King George and avoid tyranny and that whole thing. You seem to suggest, A, that's not our system, and B, it's not even a good idea. And I or not a great idea. And you're the first con law professor I've ever read to say, you know what, we shouldn't have checks and balances. And you're not saying that. We should have less checks and balances and less separation of powers. And I found that just fascinating. But I don't want to spend too much time on this because your proposals are so fascinating. But can you give me a few minutes here on how you came to that conclusion? And is there anyone else saying that? Because I don't think there is.
So I actually don't know if there's anybody else saying that.
Of course, yeah, I don't think there is.
Of course, there's that famous co-authored paper, Separation of Parties, Not Powers, that I'm sure you're familiar with. But they're not, they're not making the point that you specifically raised. They're making more of a kind of descriptive point.
Yes,
with policy implications, and it's a fantastic paper. But this is a different point. So I do want to be clear. One of the claims I make is that counterintuitively, you will have greater institutional jealousy if you relax formal separation of powers. That's really what I'm saying.
Okay, wait. We state that sentence in a way non-lawyers will get it.
Yeah. So we have this idea that we get greater accountability because each branch of government is going to have people in those branches who are jealous of their institutions. So folks in Congress are going to be jealous and they're going to protect Congress against an encroaching president or an encroaching Supreme Court. The president will protect the presidency against encroaching Supreme Court or encroaching Congress. And we can play this out. But that's just not true in a two-party system. Instead, what we see is folks who are members of the president's party jealously protecting the president against others in the same institution who seek to challenge the president. So in fact, if we had a system whereby the president's fate was tied in with a coalition, a multi-party coalition in Congress, we'd actually have greater jealousies in the sense that if the president's not serving the coalition well, the coalition will understand there are other people who could serve the coalition well. It would be less a culture of a particular person and more a culture of somebody serving in office as a font of ideas whose goal it is to actually further the objectives of the coalition in a benign way. And so my counterintuition is that we actually get greater institutional jealousies by relaxing, to some extent, separation of powers. I'm not suggesting we throw the baby out with the bathwater here. I'm really not. I keep a lot of vital American institutions. But I think that we have an erroneous conception of how our system works if we think that people who go to Congress are jealous of Congress as opposed to jealous of the prerogatives of their party, which sometimes is going to mean that they are going to be protecting the president, and sometimes it means they're going to be attacking the president, depending upon the party of the president and how it affiliates with theirs.
I don't have the skill to explain to my audience what an important point you just made. Forget everything legal mumbo-jumbo, forget political science, forget law and economics. A basic question I've always asked myself in my 33 years as a law professor, and this is not my none of this is my wheelhouse. I'm much more of a rights guy and an interpretation theoretical guy. But when people are sent to Congress here in America, they care more about their personal status, which is fine, everybody does that, and their political party than the country. And it's that last thing that kills me. It's clear to me that, and this is nonpartisan, people on both sides feel stronger about their party than the best interests of the country. Isn't that a disastrous state for a country to be in?
So I do think it's deeply problematic. And let me just mention this, and you haven't asked this question, but it undergirds your question.
Sure.
And I think it's really important for Americans to understand. So when we look at the reform literature, there are kind of two responses that grow out of what you just articulated. One is sort of an anti-party insight. Let's get rid of parties. And the other one is a pro-party insight. I'm in the latter camp.
Okay. Right?
This book is a pro-party move. And the reason for that is there is no democracy in the world that doesn't have political parties. Like water getting to its lowest point, parties will always emerge and try to manipulate and work the system in their favor. The question is never, can we have no, there is only one, there's one way to have no parties. Have a dictatorship that makes it illegal to be a member of another party.
That might be coming in America, but go ahead.
It might be. And no, that actually is a serious threat.
The point
is how it is that you can make the parties work for the interests of the citizens of the country. That's the question. Not whether we can get rid of parties. How can we deploy parties so we have benign jealousies and rivalries among parties? Make it a better game among inevitable parties. And that's really what this book is designed to demonstrate. Other countries sometimes do better, sometimes don't do better. Sometimes they fall prey to other pathologies that are similar in their effects. But the idea is, how is it that we can structure a system so that we get the benefit of competition among parties rather than being victim of an absence of meaningful competition because we only have two parties?
That makes great sense. All right, we're going to get to your proposals right now. But I do want to preface this, I think, by either asking or saying the following. Can we discuss your proposals and the history behind them and the policies behind them in this context, if the context is fair? If it's not fair, then tell me and we won't do it. It seems to me circa 2024 and circa 1795 probably, America has some advantages that other free Western European countries and free countries in South America and other places maybe have less of. And this is what I mean by that. We're not France and England and Poland and Czech, that where the Germans have invaded several times, in the centuries. We've never been invaded. 9/11, sure. Terrorism, sure. An army has never marched upon American soil since the Revolutionary War. We're not expecting threats from Mexico, and we're not, other than maybe the migrant threat we can talk about. And we're not expecting any threats from Canada, obviously. As a Canadian, I can tell you, Canada does not want to attack America. Former Canadian. So I do want to discuss how radically you want to change the way we do things in the context of, do you agree we have advantages that many other countries? France, World War II wasn't that long ago. It just wasn't. And Germans were in Paris, right? Right. So we don't have that problem. In an age of nuclear weapons, of course, we have the problem of Russia and China launching weapons at us. That's a very different problem than having an army march in. Is that a fair setup?
It is. Actually, it's a setup that it's a point that I make at the very beginning of the book,
yes,
going back to the notion,
yes,
of American exceptionalism. When I say, yes, we may have survived and thrived in spite of, not because of, our constitutional design.
Yes.
And we can think of multiple factors, right? For yes, one thing, we were relatively insulated from foreign military threats, almost uniquely. Number two,
yep,
capacity for westward expansion, albeit, yep, a tremendous pain and cost to Native American, yep, communities or tribes.
Yep.
Influx of highly motivated immigrants, right? That,
yep,
that's pretty good.
Yep.
And of course, the original sin of bringing enslaved persons here under brutal, brutal and horrific conditions and then maintaining them here under a state of abject terror. But all of these things make us exceptional, but not in the way that we're encouraged to learn as children as,
right,
part of our story of American exceptionalism. And it may be that those factors are the reason why, despite, not because of, our constitutional design, we survived and thrived. And I think that is a vital lesson. And when we need to be careful, right? We need to be careful not to commit what I sometimes call the Denmark mistake of thinking, just pick a country that looks from a distance like it's doing things very well. And imagine we just do that, right? Just be New Zealand, just be Denmark. We need to realize that some things, we are a unique country, a unique culture, and there are systems of doing democracy that are better, that are more adaptable for what we do. Actually, those models aren't too bad, actually, as it turns out. But the point that I'm trying to make is we can't idolize any particular country. We have to look at other countries. We have to recognize all democratic systems are flawed. In fact, I say in the book, they all embed anti-democratic features, including ours. Ours is imperfect. We have to look at other systems for their strengths and their weaknesses and learn how to do things better, not imagining there's some perfect system. There is no perfect system.
And I also want to say one of the best parts of this book is a very long tour of other countries. We probably won't have time. We have an hour to get to much of that today. But for people who want to read this book, if you want to learn how other countries do democracy or attempt democracy, you can't get a better source than this. It's really, really good. So congratulations.
Thank you so much for that. I appreciate it. I mean, that is really the centerpiece of the book, is the world tour to England, France, yes, Germany, Israel, Taiwan, Brazil, and Venezuela.
Well,
and I'm a reasonably good tour guide.
You have a great tour guide. It is the center part of the book. But Max, as someone who just read it, I want to just slightly disagree with you. That part of the book is really important. But I think I wouldn't call it the centerpiece of the book. I mean, you're the author. You call it whatever you want. I think you say so many interesting, provocative, fascinating things about America itself that I think, but anyway, all I'm telling
you,
the audience,
I will regard that a friendly amendment, an eminently
yes,
friendly
yes,
amendment. How's
yes,
that?
Yes. that's perfect. All right. So and by the way, for those listening, you're not going to hear very much about the Supreme Court during this podcast. You may hear a little bit at the end, but this is not a book about the Supreme Court. This is not a podcast about the Supreme Court. So it's a little bit different from ones I've done in the past. All right. Tell us how we, just for the non-lawyers listening, and you know, how do we currently elect members of the House, and how should we change that?
So presently, we go in every 2 years as voters, and we have districted elections, except for states that are so small that the entire state comprises one district.
Right.
And so we go in and we
vote. And there are two of those, right? Max, there are two of those, right?
I think there are two of those. Yeah, there are two
yeah.
of those, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe more. I think there may be more than two, but you may be right. You may be right.
Okay.
I'd have to go back. Right? One,
yeah,
one of the gifts I did not inherit from my dad was his photographic memory, unfortunately.
Yeah, me neither. Okay. You know who has one? Erwin Chemerinsky. It makes his life much easier. Go ahead.
I have to say that explains a lot to me about Erwin Chemerinsky.
He literally has a photographic memory. He can read something and it's implanted forever. It's amazing. Go ahead.
All right. Well, in any event, I'll just remain jealous for an additional reason.
Yes. Me too. You and me both. Yes.
As if I didn't have enough already. You know?
Yes. All right. The House.
So we go in every 2 years and we choose somebody to represent us in the House of Representatives. And as I previously said, when you have a geographically defined election, the goal is to keep your side intact, divide the opposition. So we end up with two parties dominating those races. And one of the real problems with the House of Representatives, in the aftermath of Obama's first election, Republican operatives realized that they could manipulate those district lines in the House. And I'll connect this back up for a minute. The best telling of this story is by David Daley. I don't know if you ever had him on your podcast.
No, David and I have worked together. He's terrific.
Okay. So David Daley, former editor of Salon, he wrote a book with the unceremonious title Rat Effed, right? And basically the story of why your vote doesn't count.
I actually read a draft of that book for him. It was great.
Oh, fantastic. Well, it's a great story and a great telling of the story.
Yes.
I recommend it to your readers, to your audience. So he tells the story how Republican operatives, for pennies on the dollar, would go after these below the radar sort of state house elections, flip enough purple and blue states red, and then they would draw the lines for the House of Representatives and make them sort of hyper-partisan gerrymanders. And the idea, the concept, they thought they had the House entrenched for 20 years. That was a little more ambitious than it ended up being. It flipped back sooner. But the consequence is that House elections are not competitive. Now, that's not precisely right. They're not competitive in the general election. In the general election, our representatives are choosing us, not the other way around. But they are competitive in the primaries. The problem with that is that in the primaries, it makes the parties move further apart. Because if you're not close enough to the base, you'll get primaried by somebody who is, which creates this two-party growing divergence between them. So what I'm proposing we do for
can we pause right there, Max? Can we pause right
there?
Because that was a fantastic explanation for what's happening in America today. What you're saying is, in non-competitive House races where one party, because of gerrymandering or any other reason, is dominant and is likely going to win, the real election is the primary. And if the real election is the primary, then as everyone, I think most people know, let's just talk about the Republican Party right now. If you are a moderate Republican in a very red state, you're in big trouble because you're going to be challenged on red district because you're going to be challenged by a more right-wing Trump-type person. And the winner of that's going to win the election because you're already in a gerrymandered district.
Absolutely.
And the same thing happens, and the exact same thing happens in liberal districts with Democrats. So Democrats and Republicans move farther apart because all the work is being done at the primary level. Is that what you just said?
Precisely right. And just to be clear, this is not impressionistic. This is not some subjective intuition. If you look at the Pew Research data, they actually show this in graphic form, and it's reproduced in my book. And you can look from the early 90s until the late teens, and you see the centers of the two parties growing further and further apart, precisely in the period in which this occurred.
Do you think somewhere in the 90s, Justice Souter wrote a dissent in a partisan gerrymandering case? And of all the justices to do this, he was the least likely to do it because he was the least, I think, technological of any justice we've ever. But he suggested that there's a sea change coming and has come. And that it's always been gerrymandering, he said, but computers have changed everything. Everything. Now we can pinpoint voter behavior with absolute accuracy.
Yeah.
Was he right about that?
I can't remember the precise case in which you wrote that. And I know that was thematic of all the cases where Kennedy kind of held the center and the possibility that there might be an equal protection violation that could be vindicated. I mean, we flirted since Davis versus
First Amendment violation.
Yeah, or First Amendment violation. Yeah. We flirted for decades with the idea that hyperpartisan gerrymandering might someday satisfy Justice Kennedy where he could find a violation. But of course, he stepped off the court before that happened. And basically that ended that in the Rucho case.
Yes.
But I don't precisely recall, again, that photographic memory thing, the specific Souter opinion that you're describing, but it seems intuitively It resonates with me. Yes, that all makes sense that he would.
His main point was in a world where in 1910 or 1870 or 1790, you can guess voter behavior, but it's all guesswork. But now you can pinpoint it with absolute accuracy. Anyway, let's move on.
Stunning scientific precision. Yeah, that's exactly right. So what I'm proposing. Let me just say, I'm proposing three amendments that take on what I'll call two axes of democracy. And this sort of grows out of the world tour. All democratic systems have to confront choices along two axes. One, how we elect typically the lower chamber in a bicameral legislative body. And then the other one is how we select and hold accountable the head of government. So my amendments are kind of tied together, but we're focusing on the first one, which is how you elect the House of Representatives. And the system that I am advocating is that the name of it in the literature is mixed member proportionality. And so instead of going in and voting just for the district election, you will still vote for a district candidate, but you'll have two ballots in the House of Representatives. So your first ballot will be just like what you do now. And that includes the members in their gerrymandered districts, right? So because that's going to be a geographical district, you're going to have two parties dominating that choice. However, your second ballot's going to be by party. Now, think about our parties. We have two main parties, Democrats and Republicans, but embedded beneath them are probably between four and six parties. The Democrats roughly split into progressives and traditional Democrats. Republicans split into traditional GOP and kind of America First or MAGA. There might be a Green Party. There might be a Libertarian Party. So we can get, we can envision about five or six parties here. Let's say you're a progressive Democrat, and so and you go in for your second ballot, and what you want to do is you want to signal, well, the Democrats are probably going to lead the coalition negotiations, but I want them to form a coalition with the progressives. You'll vote for the progressive party. Or let's say you're a moderate Republican. You'll vote in all likelihood for the Republican candidate in the district election, but you might actually want a grand coalition between centrist Democrats and centrist Republicans. You might vote either Democrat or you might vote GOP, right? In other words, you're able to send a more surgically precise signal as to what it is you value as a voter, and we get rid of what I call the third party dilemma, because today, when you vote for a third party, you get punished for doing so. If you vote for somebody to the left of the Democrat, right of the Republican, you're throwing weight to the major party candidate that you least prefer, or you may vote for a candidate who's pulling votes in from both sides, and there wasn't really a good term for it, so I call it a randomizer. You may end up making it a random outcome between the two leading candidates. Now, suddenly, you're going to send a real signal about where your values are, and I don't want to jump ahead of your question, but through the Second Amendment, I'll demonstrate how instead of getting punished for those third-party votes, suddenly you get rewarded. But let me go back to the mechanism.
Hold on, Max, 1 second.
Yeah.
So what you're suggesting on the ground is everybody goes into a voting booth and votes for the person they want to represent them in their district, like we do now, and a second choice of whatever political parties have garnered enough signatures. That's not important, but, you know, 4 or 5 or 6 political parties. And you get to pick which party you favor along with the person you're voting for the district. That does not require a constitutional amendment?
Oh, no. It isn't. I'm proposing 3 constitutional amendments.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
All constitutional
amendments. I thought you said, okay. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
No. These are all constitutional amendments. And so what happens is, on a state-by-state basis, we take the proportional votes and we use it to ensure that each state's delegation to the House of Representatives is chosen through proportionality. Now, we're not going to get perfect proportionality because of the math with different sized states, but the goal isn't perfect proportionality. The goal is to have what I call good enough proportionality, by which I mean, although two parties will dominate, they won't get a majority. In order to form a majority, they're going to have to join with other parties, so we break the two parties' stranglehold.
And that is, I think, the most important contribution of your book, right?
Well, thank you.
That sentence. I mean, there are a lot. There are 25 of them, but that is right there. And I want to explain it in non-legal terms to folks because I think it's so important. We need a government that can work together; otherwise, we can't get things done. Now it may be person A thinks the government should be really big, person B moderate big, person C very small federal government. But whatever government you want it to protect us in national defense. Maybe you want it to protect us from climate change, and you certainly want us to be able to run the country in an efficient way. Right now, all you get are 2 choices, and they're pretty radically far apart. What you're saying is bring more smart people into the room, bring more views into the room, negotiate among more than just polar opposite positions. Sometimes in Europe, I know, that leads to a standstill and that leads to stuff, but we already have standstill. We had the filibuster in the late 1950s that caused our Congress to stop. We have, of course, the filibuster in the Senate today that causes our country to stop. I think that contribution, bring in more viewpoints to make better decisions, is so important. It's just so important.
Let me just add one thing to that. Imagine the difference in the campaigns for a moment, right? So right now, the two parties run campaigns of denigration. Our society is so divided and our political parties are so divided. It used to be that you would imagine that somebody might have read the same source materials with which you're familiar and in good faith come out to a different place. You and I are old enough to remember those times.
But today,
we regard people who disagree with us on fundamental questions as either lacking basic intelligence or as evil. In order to campaign successfully in the system that I propose, you would have to campaign and say, you know, we stand for the policies of our party, but we can form a successful coalition with other parties. We may disagree with them on some things. We might even disagree strongly with them on some things. But here's what we have in common. We are all committed to the notion of democratic governance and the objectives of serving the people. And we can find common ground to achieve that. Just imagine how different that will feel and imagine how good it will feel to go into the voting booth and actually vote for a party that you sincerely believe in, as opposed to choosing the lesser of two evils every single time you vote.
Let me see if I have this right, and then we'll move on to your second proposal, which is, all these proposals are interrelated. It's a package deal here. We need all 3. So let's say there's some controversy or debate in my school about student activity, student speakers, student speech, everything all law schools are going through. You know, if we were going to try to solve the problem in a helpful, productive way, we would invite students from FedSoc. We would invite students from the American Constitution Society. And hopefully, we would invite students with allegiance to neither and maybe even allegiance to both in some ways, get as many views in the room as we can within reason, and come up with a solution that not everyone is going to love, but everyone can at least say the game was fair and the solution is reasonable, even if I don't disagree. Even if I don't agree wholeheartedly with it, I got a little bit, and that's all I can ask for in this multi-diverse environment. That makes so much more sense than just inviting ACS and FedSoc and letting them scream at each other.
Absolutely, yes? Absolutely right. And one of the things that we want is an agreement on the rules of the game so the rules aren't being manipulated every single time. Right.
Yes.
And if you have faith that although I didn't get what I wanted this time, there's going to be another round and it's a fair set of rules, I can accept as legitimate an outcome that may not have given me what I wanted. And that's what's missing today. This fundamental distrust, because we have the sense that everything's being manipulated depending upon who has control of the reins.
Yeah. And as you point out in the book, I can't go into it right now. The media is a big part of that, but we got to put that in the back burner because we're running
out. No, I totally understand.
So proposal one, change the way we elect the House, make it far more proportional and not so bipolar. I'm oversimplifying, but that's the...
I have no problem with that simplification. That's good.
Okay. Number two, and this is going to shock a lot of people, but before you tell number two, I want to remind the non-lawyers listening and maybe the lawyers listening, we don't elect the president. We elect people who elect the president. And that isn't the same thing. Now go with proposal two.
All right. So this is the most radical part of the proposal.
Yes.
I am proposing that we essentially eliminate people as citizens voting for the president, and in descending order of proportional representation in the House, up to five party leaders will negotiate a majority coalition. The party that succeeds will have its pre-designated slate for president and vice president assume those offices precisely on the same schedule we have now, same line of succession as we have now, and I have a backstop to avoid the problem that many parliamentary systems have of endlessly negotiating. I actually have a backstop threat point because as the number one economy in the world, the largest superpower in the world, we can't afford indeterminacy. We can't afford uncertainty as to whether we'll have a government. We have to be able to convey certainty in that regard domestically and abroad, and I have a mechanism to achieve it. But the idea is suddenly we will have coalitions and consensus as the model of our government, which means we're no longer in a winner-take-all zero-sum game. And the way I look at it, I'm not taking away power from citizens. I'm giving power to citizens. You're actually going to have far greater input into conveying what it is you truly value and what it is you actually are hoping the party will do for you. Because here's the thing. Imagine that you're that liberal, that you're that progressive Democrat, and you voted for the Democrat and you vote for the Democratic candidate in your district and the Progressive Party. Now look at the Progressive Party. The Progressive Party may say to the GOP or to the Democrats, I'll join your coalition if, what follows the if you give us certain policy concessions that my constituents care about, if you give us certain appointments to the cabinet, if the next seat that becomes available in the Supreme Court goes to one of ours. Now when you voted for the Progressive Party, you're not punished for it. You're rewarded for it. You're not going to get everything you want, and you're not going to get all three of those things necessarily, but you're going to get something that matters to you. And effective party leaders are going to have to make choices. Which of the priorities is the highest priority? And that's the way politics should be, right?
So, Max, I agree. And when I read that proposal when I read your book, something else hit me. And I read your book. I didn't memorize your book, so I apologize if you covered this somewhere, but. I don't think you did. When I read through all of that, you know what kept going through? I mean, I liked the politics of it, but that's not what went through my mind. And I think a lot of people will have this thought that I have when they read that part of your book. What I was thinking was, boy, would my life be better. I mean, literally, on the ground. Now, again, I'm very fortunate. I'm not in a factory working 12 hours a day having to put food on my family's table. But in my place in life, boy, would I be happier. And I think this is true for a lot of people. If we didn't have to live with the kind of presidential elections we have now. I mean, the 2 years of just constant barrage of awfulness on both sides. Your proposal does away with that to some significant degree. And that is an awesome byproduct. We can debate what's a good democracy. We can debate what's good politics. We can debate various different types of parliamentary and non-parliamentary governments. What we cannot debate, I think, is most Americans are really sick of the presidential election as it currently is. Is that fair?
I think it's absolutely right. I mean, the recent poll, 63% are so dissatisfied with the choices that the parties
yes.
are giving. It's terrible.
Yes.
And, you know,
yes.
we're looking at an election. You know, we're in a constitutional crisis. We're looking at an election between Joe Biden, who really doesn't make his base enthusiastic, and who could lose to somebody
yes.
who is facing 91 serious felony indictments and who knows what the Supreme Court's going to do, but literally could be convicted on a serious set of felonies before the election cycle is out and yet could win. It is hard to imagine who, looking at this objectively, would say, oh, that's good. That's a good way to do democracy.
Well, I think you could, but see, although your book is not about this, I think people, again, I want to be clear. The book is Parliamentary America by Maxwell Stearns. Buy it. I want to be clear about this. Although it's not the direct subject of your book does explain how we got here, how we got. We're so polarized that even a candidate, two candidates. I've disliked, I'm a Democrat progressive. I've disliked a lot of Joe Biden's decisions for a long time, going back to Clarence Thomas and the disaster that he did with that episode. I'm so glad he's president, not Trump. I don't have the words to explain. But I'm not happy with him. I'd rather have somebody else. I'd rather have somebody other than Trump. But the notion that our system has produced this choice, I think is because we're so polarized and because of the many different defects in our system you recognize. So although you did not write this book for that purpose, and I'm guessing you started thinking about this long before 2016 in terms of your core ideas, this book explains how we got to where we are. That alone is a substantial contribution to the literature. So congratulations on that.
Well, first of all, thank you for saying that. I really do appreciate it. I mean,
it's true.
You know, I'll just say this. You know, this is not a book I envisioned myself writing. If somebody said 15 years ago, you're going to write a book about how to fix American democracy, I would have said, no, that's crazy. But honestly, I felt like I had to because so many proposals to how to fix our democracy actually won't fix it, going back to the pathology point. They get the pathology wrong, and they get the enactability point wrong. A lot of people think the thing we have to avoid is amending the Constitution, but most of the proposals that are out there, even if they could be accomplished statutorily, translated to unemployment acts for sitting members of the House of Representatives or the Senate. And mine is the only proposal that leaves every member of the House and Senate an incumbent in their district or state. And so it's enactable, right? If we actually had a constitutional convention that threw out these other ideas, suddenly this is a pressure release valve that lets sitting members of Congress fix the problem and claim to be the heroes of democracy. And you know what? You and I may hate these people or dislike them, but let them be the heroes of democracy so long as they produce a thriving, genuinely legitimate multi-party democracy, right? That's the goal. You know, and it's not going to solve all our problems. But once we're a thriving democracy, there are so many other problems that we can take
yes,
on.
I agree.
As a nation, you mentioned the Supreme Court and the Senate, right? The reason those aren't the core proposal of my book is because fixing those things won't solve the crisis. But they are things to be fixed. There's a chicken and egg problem. The way to do it is first to create a thriving multi-party system. And then we can take on the problems of the Senate, problems of the Supreme Court, problems of substantive policy, climate change, guns, all these other things. But we first have to be a truly thriving, functional, legitimate democracy, which we are not, but we can be. And I wrote this book, and I wrote it not for an academic audience. It is Johns Hopkins Press, but it's on their trade press side. I wrote this in a way that I think is accessible, that people can read and understand, because I think we really have to go back and revisit things that we've thought are true since we were children.
So your third proposal, to me, actually, is the one that I think it's easiest to explain. But more importantly, if we weren't so dysfunctional and we could just have a constitutional amendment discussion, it is, you know, a real discussion in America. I think, leaving aside your first two proposals, Your first two are related. The third one is also related. It could stand on its own, and it would be an amazing improvement to America for the following reasons. Two reasons. One, everybody agrees impeachment is broken, and it's likely to be impeachment of the president is broken and is likely to get worse. It's going to get worse, certainly. Second, maybe even more importantly, though, we have no way to realistically judge a president's performance while he is or she is president. And the next one you're about to explain gets to that. And I think most Americans would say, our presidency is too strong. We need to weaken it somehow. This is not what and if you're an originalist, it's not what the founding fathers anticipated by any stretch of the imagination. So give us your third proposal. It'll be obvious. And I think it's a great one. Go ahead.
So the general idea, like imagine that you could go back in a time machine, like back to the future, to the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in the 1780s and ask them, knock on the door and say, hey, do you think that if this country survives for 240 years under the system you're devising, the American people will never elect a president that should be removed under the impeachment clause you're talking
right.
about?
Right, right.
I think that would elicit the response you just gave me, Eric. Right? Like
yes.
they would laugh, right?
Yes.
Like,
yes.
Of course not. No
right.
electorate gets it right every single time. And yet right. we've never successfully removed a president under the impeachment clause. Why?
Yeah. Although, in all fairness, I think Nixon resigned because he knew he was going.
I was about to say the one exception is the impeachment that didn't occur. The one exception is Richard Nixon, right?
Which is
a fair point. But the larger point remains, right? That it just doesn't seem to work.
And we've had terrible presidents before Trump. I mean, really terrible presidents before Trump.
Oh, yeah. We're gifted.
Yeah.
You know, we're gifted in whom we select.
Yes.
So the point is that it's because of the fact that the two-party game overtook the rock, paper, scissors game. And so what I'm suggesting is if we have a true multi-party democracy, which the first two together will produce, we also need to fix this problem and make sure that we have genuine accountability. And the mechanism that I propose is to have a supermajority, it's a pretty high bar still, 60% of the House of Representatives be able to remove the president based on a no-confidence vote for maladministration. And what I do there is I don't define maladministration in a legal, technical way, but I give examples going back through some recent history, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, George W. Bush, and of course, Donald Trump, examples of behaviors that I don't make a final judgment on. People can think about whether what they've done may or may not rise to the level of maladministration. But
Can I interrupt for 1 second? Because
yes.
that part of the book was so forceful. I thought Bill Clinton should resign, not because he had an affair, that's between he and Hillary, because he had an affair with an intern. And if you're president of the United States, you don't have sex with interns. You just don't. But the great part of your proposal is, so I thought he should resign. I know a lot of feminists who are upset with him, but didn't think he should resign because of what could happen. We could have that discussion for real under your system. Under this system, we really can't even have it for real.
Exactly, because people are so locked in. You know, one of the consequences of our two-party system is you have to acquiesce in even the most outrageous positions
yes.
of
yes.
those in your coalition because. Because if you fracture your side, you throw power to the other side. But in a competitive multi-party system, that's not true, which is actually why the one modification I would say to what you previously said, I actually think the Third Amendment is really intricately related to the first two, right?
Sure.
It grows out of a multi-party system, right? I think it wouldn't work as well in a two-party system, but I do think—
Although the 60% feature strikes me— It would be better than our current system. That's all.
Oh, it'd be better than what we have now, right?
Yeah.
But
yes.
it wouldn't really solve the crisis that we're in,
right?
And so, but in any event, but you've got the right idea, and I do think that my goal here isn't to have this thing deployed with regularity and start removing presidents. Rather, it's to make presidents more accountable. Right?
Yes, and more moderate.
That puts them in power.
Yes.
And the interest of the American people.
It'll end up being more moderate. It just will under the system. Max, we have just a few minutes left. So I mentioned on this podcast before, I usually send my guests a rough roadmap and then we improvise. And that's what I'm about to do. So I apologize for not giving you this question in advance. And this is going to be a hard one. And it's not about it's not about the thesis of your book per se. So let me just recap for a minute. Max has written a book about how to change America. I am convinced if I could snap my fingers and have these changes done, I would do it. I might have some modifications, some friendly amendments, but I think this is a much better country than the one we have now. Congratulations for this. And if people also, but even if you think that's never going to happen, this book is really valuable for telling us how we got to where we are. So I want to put that on the record. People should read this book. Now, here's my question to you. And now I'm talking to you as an academic, and not just a legal academic, a professor of any discipline. You and I both know that this is the guy who said the court's not a court and we should abandon that idea forever, knowing that's never going to happen or probably not going to happen fully in this country. These proposals are they're not going to happen in your lifetime, almost certainly. That's a shame, but it's true. We all know this. But that's not the role of academics. Our role is not to change the country. Our role is to come up with ideas other people can chew on. So here's my big question. Knowing that there's a very small possibility of these proposals getting actually adopted in the real world, I went into this book with a fairly good idea of what you were saying, and I still love the book, even though I know it's not going to happen or probably not going to happen. How should academics view that idea of academics throwing, and it could be physics, doesn't have to be law, throwing out into the world ideas that are interesting, provocative, smart, controversial, worthy of discussion, but will likely not affect the real world at all? What do we do with that?
Can I break that into a two-part question if we get time for me to do that?
100%.
Okay. So I am going to break it into these two questions. Do I really mean it?
Yes.
And even if I am overly optimistic, because the answer to that question is yes, and let me explain why, right? Even if I'm wrong about that, and I don't think I am, what do I think about the idea of academics throwing ideas into the world that may not come to fruition?
Hold on. On that last thing, will probably not come to fruition is how I'd like you to phrase that.
Okay, fine. That probably will not come to fruition.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let me be clear. One of the things I say in the book is, you know, I'm a professor, I'm not a seer. These ideas may not come to fruition. These ideas could come to fruition in a short period of time, but it may not be for several years. It might be after I'm dead, right? Who knows?
Or never.
I don't know when the inflection point will be, but I do think we are in a genuine constitutional crisis. It's like watching two colliding trains. One possibility is the trains collide and we just collapse or go into autocracy. So I've been giving a lot of talks, and one of the things I've said is that there are two important things Americans need to do. Number one, they have to educate themselves, and that means re-educating themselves, and that's one of the reasons I wrote the book. The other one is they have to be optimistic. The American project deeply matters, not just domestically, but across the globe. I truly believe that the American project deeply matters. And if we are going to hit that inflection point and we have the wrong conversations with respect to reform, it's vital that there's a tool available that actually demonstrates what the proper diagnosis is, what's required to fix it, and how, because unlike those other proposals, this one actually allows members of the House and Senate to keep their jobs and create as their legacy a thriving democracy. This actually is enactable, even as compared to non-amended proposals. So I am actually more optimistic than you may be about the plausibility of these ideas. And that's a hill I'm willing to die on.
Okay.
I actually do believe this is plausible, but I do want to answer the other question because I think it matters so profoundly, and I love that you asked it, and I don't get asked it enough. I think as academics, one of the things that is vital for us to do is to recognize that unlike so many people in so many careers, we have the really profound luxury of thinking about, focusing on, researching things that we decide matter. And I think that is the ultimate gift of being an academic. And I think that what we need to do is use that gift in a significant way. Don't focus on the arcane thing that you might get tenure off by not rising, you're not getting anybody upset. Get people upset.
Well, that's the story of my – Max, as you know, that's the story of my life, but go ahead.
Yeah. Pick things that matter. Write about things that are profound. One of the things that has been sort of a lifelong thing that I've been, you know, saying to junior colleagues throughout my career is write fewer pieces that matter more and are better produced, right? Don't think of this mission of being a professor as, you know, sort of a production cycle, must get out.
Yeah.
Writing's on a calendar. Write half as many articles, a third as many articles. Just make them damn good. Make them really matter. Choose topics that matter. And the thing is, if you do that well, and not just a lot, in any field, you might be chasing something that seems really obscure to the people hanging around in your in your institution. But it might take 20, 30 years for somebody to figure out, well, actually, that thing you were chasing turned out to matter. Stuff that was getting attention at the time you were writing.
When you say that, that's my story. I wrote something in 2012 that nobody, not a soul, except maybe Judge Posner. There it is. That's my one reference to Judge Posner. Nobody agreed with. Today, a lot of people agree with me. It took a decade and some political stuff. But your point is valid there. That originality plus not stupid plus time is a pretty good formula.
Right. And I guess I would say, you know, this is hard for academics. Being an academic you're right. It's better. It's way better than most jobs. Like I love my job. But there is a frustration to it, which is there is often a tendency to chase getting attention for the sake of it. I think it's a mistake. Chase good and important ideas.
Yep. That's great advice.
That, to me, is the most important thing.
And that's really great advice. I want to end this with this. Among the many great things in your book is a line that I want my audience to listen to hear, and to really understand. Because this, I'm trying to think of a reference that won't be too old for the audience. But the other day I was watching Brian's Song on cable. It's an old, old movie.
Oh, I remember Brian's Song very well.
I know. But our audience will not. My audience will not. So it's an old movie about a white and black football player in the 60s when race tensions were high and they were best friends and the white guy dies of cancer. And it's a great movie. Watch it, everybody.
Fantastic movie.
But here's my point about that. The movie begins with "every true story ends in death." That's the first line of that movie. And this is a true story. It's from Hemingway, I think. It is a great line. And once that line is uttered, you're into the movie. Every true story ends in death. And this is a true story. You have a line that is so important. "We are the framers." I loved that line in your book, because we are in a constitutional crisis. By definition, if Donald Trump might win the presidency, we are in a constitutional crisis. But there are 15 other reasons as well. A hyperpartisan Supreme Court, a broken Senate, and the House that doesn't do what the people want it to do. We are the framers. If Americans take that message and read your book, we'll be a better country. So thank you for writing it. Thank you for that message. And thank you for being on Supreme Minutes.
Eric, thank you so much for hosting me. It really was a pleasure.
I will again. You were here. Thanks.